Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What really works against Islamic extremist violence, and how has U.S. policy gotten it wrong? Our efforts in the Middle East tend to focus on disabling those who might wish us harm, often through the use or at least the threat of military might. But my guest today believes we have been all but ignoring a major channel for reducing fundamentalist animosity, the transformative power of trade to create a stable and moderate middle class. Vali Nasser is professor of international relations at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. His latest book is called Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. Vali, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Where is the Islamic middle class most vibrant in the modern world?
Well, it's most vibrant where the economies of those countries are most integrated into the global economy, where there is the least degree of government control of the economy, and that a private sector is enabled to produce and consume and finance trade and commerce and engage the global economy most. So countries like Malaysia, Turkey, Dubai, Indonesia is where we see this middle class most active. But elsewhere in countries like Morocco, Tunisia, even other parts of the Arab world, as well as Iran and Pakistan, to the extent that commerce and trade is available, we're seeing it active.
Can you talk about the sorts of restrictions and obligations that Sharia law would place on middle-class Muslims in terms of how they conduct financial business?
Well, Sharia law is essentially law, which demands of Muslims that they adhere to certain strictures, for instance, as to whether or not they charge interest or are able to pay interest. But that does not necessarily dissuade them from engaging in business. And what happens is that as this middle class, that part of it which is religious, is becoming more wealthy, it's consuming various goods that it believes that do not violate the Sharia or allow it to be both religious and commercial. So we're seeing in these places a rise of capitalism and middle-class behavior that is still close to religion in the same manner as we may see it in other countries where middle classes are both interested in consumption and production but yet want to retain religious values.
And what's so fascinating here is as you write about it, the countries that, where Sharia law is important that are interacting and trading with countries where it is not the major source of law, it ultimately breeds some extraordinary creativity in finding ways to make this work.
Absolutely, because the key issue we have to understand when we talk about the middle class in the Muslim world, the key issue is not religion or no religion, whether the businessmen are religious or not religious. The key issue is that whether businessmen are actually capitalist and engaged in global economy or not. When they become engaged in global economy, when they gain in wealth, when they act as a private sector, act as middle classes elsewhere, they begin to demand that they be able to consume and enjoy fruits of their wealth. And that means that they want to go on vacations, they want to put their money in banks, they buy financial goods, they go shopping, except that they may buy things that are different from other people in the sense that they would want to put their money in mutual funds or banks that are tailored to their religious values, or if they go on a cruise or on a vacation, or when they go shopping, they buy things that are in accordance with their religious values. The religion part is not as important as the fact that these middle classes very much behave as middle classes everywhere else do, which is pursuit of wealth, belief in a high quality of life, and the desire to consume and spend and live well.
On the other hand, you are not saying here for a moment that a strong and economically empowered middle class will detract from faith or keep people from practicing their faith.
Well, not initially. I mean, it doesn't do that in America either. We talk about middle America where you or so-called red states, where you have plenty of very capitalist businessmen who are also churchgoers and believe in family values, and they don't see any discrepancy with being economically modern and yet religiously very pious. And that's the case also with this new Muslim middle class. What participation in the global economy and wealth is doing is not to turn them secular, but it turns their religion into, in a much more moderate direction, in the sense that they want to practice piety and they want to believe in God and they want to go to the mosque, but they are much more interested in a form of religion that is compatible with their economic activities and with their desire and quality of life. They're not interested in extremism or violence or the sort of clash of with a modern world or with the West. Now, over time, economic forces may compel other changes in them. But for now, wealth and commerce and trade is not incompatible with faith.
And I guess it stands to reason that that moderating influence on the middle classes would also promote internal stability within Islamic countries.
Well, anywhere around the world we look, where stability, prosperity, and democracy is associated with a middle class that has its roots in economic activity, and it's the trendsetter in culture and politics. Now, if the Muslim world, in our eyes, is too unstable or is extremist, it's because it doesn't have enough middle class. And my argument is that the problem is not religious or political per se in the Muslim world. It's by and large the absence of this class. Now, this class is absent because you don't have free economic activity in the Muslim world. Most economies are very closed down. They're controlled by governments, be they religious or secular. And as a result, you don't have this stabilizing force at the heart of Muslim society.
Vali Nasser is my guest. His new book is called Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. Vali, what role do you see free commerce or at least the ability for global commerce playing in cultivating democracy within any particular state?
Well, democracy is a political idea that is based on a system of checks and balances, elections, accountability, and the like. But this social class that is always promoted democracy and guaranteed its stability is the middle class. And by and large, it's because the economic interests of the middle class, especially when it's integrated into the global community and is involved in trade and commerce, rests with certain degree of openness of culture and politics. And even political scientists often think that there is a tipping point where countries, after a certain degree of wealth, most of them open up. We saw that with South Korea and Taiwan, which after a certain degree of wealth that they generated under military dictatorships, ultimately the pressures of their participation in the global economy forced them to democratize. We saw that in early modern Europe. We've seen it in Latin America and the like. And therefore, we hope that in the Muslim world also the rise of a middle class will have the same kind of impact on democracy. But once you have democracy, that's not enough. You have to have the ability to sustain democracy, and a sustainable democracy requires a stable economic system, and a stable economic system that is working with the rest of the world needs a private sector and the middle class.
How does a strong middle class tend to affect foreign policy decisions?
Well, not directly, but you cannot have a stable middle class of the kind, say, we also have in India, in Latin America, and China, without having the country properly integrated into the global economy. And when you're integrated into the global economy, where your wealth and prosperity depends on global economy, you cannot be at war with the world. It's not good for your interests. But in cases I looked around the Muslim world, it was very obvious that when you had businessmen, some of whom were very religious, for instance, the ones I met in Turkey, they were mosque-going, but they were doing direct business with retailers and manufacturers in Europe, they themselves understood that a kind of Islam and a kind of foreign policy for Turkey that would be on a path of confrontation with Europe, with the United States, would not be good for their business. So they became, even though they're very religious, they're a force for harmonious relations between Turkey and Europe, and harmonious relations between Turkey and the United States. Now, this is not an ideological position. It's very much something that has to do with their economic interests.
What differentiates a country like Turkey or Dubai, where things are going so well from the standpoint of opening up and developing and maintaining a large middle class, from countries like Iran and Pakistan? Where is the disconnect?
Well, you know, when we look at a case of Turkey, we may come up with many reasons why it's done so well. It's fairly educated. It had a long history of secularism and the like. But the single most important why Turkey is now one of the one of the world's largest economies. It's included in the group of 20 largest economies which recently gathered in Pittsburgh, G20. What put Turkey over there and then made it a viable democracy since 2002 is the fact that the Turkish economy began to open up to globalization from the 1980s onwards. The Turkish government removed tariffs, reformed its exchange rate system, began to invest in export viable products and industries, and encourage these businessmen to directly engage the global economy. The government, by and large, got out of the way and removed regulations and red tape and all kinds of constraints. As a result, you had the boom of a new industrial sector in Turkey, which was by and large in the middle of the country. It was run by religious small-town businessmen who became part of the global economy. And it is that revolution in Turkey that transformed Turkey into what we see it today. If you look at a country like Dubai, which is a small little Arab kingdom, it decided about two decades ago to turn itself into a free port. It removed all regulations, removed taxation, encouraged foreign business and investment to come in, and then created laws that were business and investment friendly. And the result was fantastic. Not only did Westerners and Asians and Russians come to Dubai, but Muslims from Iran, Pakistan, and the Arab world who couldn't do business in their own countries and be global businessmen in their own countries went to Dubai to become global businessmen. So whatever other excuses and reasons there are, we know that the fundamentally most important transformative effect is when governments stop choking the economy and regulating the economy and actually open up and allow their economies to become part of the world economy, is that you have this transformation caused by wealth and the rise of a middle class.
So you still have this extraordinarily high unemployment rate in Iran in particular. Can you talk about the cause and then the effect of that reality?
Well, there is plenty of cases, not just Iran, Pakistan, in the Arab world, where you have very young populations. Some countries have over 60% of their population are considered to be youth, which means that the bottom of the pyramid, population pyramid in the Muslim world is very large, and the economies are not growing rapidly enough to generate jobs for them. And one consequence of that is gradual deepening poverty. Another one is growing extremism in some countries. And in Iran, the case was sort of some of the unrest that we saw over the summer. The youth factor is very important in the Muslim world. But the youth factor right now is a destabilizing factor, because anytime you have countries that can't provide jobs for a very young population, you have to worry that at some point in time you're going to have instability. Now, the only way to address this problem is for these economies to grow faster. And they are not able to grow faster unless they open up to the world. So it is not only that it's a good thing for them to open up to the world, because then they would produce a middle class that would be a force for moderation. It is important for them to open up to the world, because that's the only way in which they may address this youth problem.
Vali Nasser is my guest. He's professor of international relations at Tufts University. His new book is called Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. We'll take your calls right after the break. You can get on the line now at 1-800-933-5372, or if you prefer, send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Vali Nasser. He is professor of international relations at Tufts University. His newest book is called Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phones now to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey, Chris. I'll try to encapsulate this as succinctly as possible. One of the true problems that I find with Christianity is the kind of hypocrisy that exists between the idea of being a devout Christian, and by that I mean like Christ, taken in the literal term. I meet and obviously see a lot of people who are very rich and also consider themselves to be very devout Christians. Again, taking that literal translation of what it means to be a Christian, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me because, you know, Jesus was someone who basically just had the clothes on his back, and that was one of his wonderful virtues, was to take a life of poverty to show his faith in what he believed and what he stood for. Now, of course, you know, in our country, we have even gone so far as to create kind of a different direction within Christianity that has used specific passages from the Bible taken out of context in order to somehow validate the idea that you can be Christian and also very wealthy at the same time. My question for your guest is, being someone that doesn't know too much about Islam myself, do those same tenets apply to Islam? And if so, does he find a possibility of the same type of hypocrisy and irony arising with this growth of the new middle class and this new application of materialism and wealth on a culture that wasn't quite as connected to it beforehand?
Thanks so much for your call. Vali, what do you think?
Well, every religion will face the same kind of a conflict. Islam at its core has no problem with business. The Prophet Muhammad was a businessman himself. There's plenty of support for business activity. But at the same time, Islam is a religion of justice, and it does call for social justice and equity and balance in society. Now, capitalism is a force for change globally. It's been throughout European history. It's been throughout modern history, bringing other parts of the world from Asia to Latin America up into much greater prosperity. Much of the wealth and prosperity and good life that we enjoy in the West or many other countries in Asia or Latin America or Europe do has to do with the rise of capitalism. But on the other hand, capitalism, if not checked and if not administered properly, can create enormous amount of inequality in society between the very wealthy and the very poor. And if there is not, and if it's not checked, it also can wreak havoc on people's lives, as we saw recently with the economic downturn of 2008. So, you know, capitalism has to be obviously managed, and every religion has to. The religious values do at some point clash with the values of capitalism, because capitalism can challenge the values of social justice and equity that religions hold. And that will be a challenge for Muslims as well. But it is not a problem there right now. In other words, in most of the Muslim world, what you have is not real, genuine capitalism. You have governments that hold the money, either from oil or from sale of other things or from international aid. They disperse the money. There is corruption. People at the top get wealthy. There is a lot of poverty. But this is not caused by capitalist activity. If there is capitalism in the Muslim world and you have genuinely the economy is growing because of capitalism, at some point in time, the issues that your caller called will become much more central Muslim issues. But they're not right now, because the Muslim world does not have the same kind of problems that we do in the United States. You don't really have a sort of triumphant, dominant capitalism that then you would have to try to correct its mistakes.
What specific actions can be taken from the West that would encourage and develop the middle class and the growth of the middle class in the Middle East?
Well, you know, it is not anything new. It is the same kind of policies that opened up Latin America, Eastern Europe, and Asia to the global economy, which means that you have to, economies in those countries have to deregulate. They have to remove barriers to trade, and they have to change their laws and practices to become business-friendly. These are everything from changing your laws about joint venture partnerships with foreign companies, about business arbitration, about regulation of business. All of these would have to change. And you know, we've done this before. International economic agencies have done this before. I gave the case of Turkey. There are other Muslim cases like Indonesia who have at various points been mandated by international economic agencies to do these things. Why more of this hasn't happened in the Arab world is for two reasons. One is that the Arab world, some parts of it is very wealthy with oil, so it really doesn't need trade, and it doesn't need to open up, and it doesn't need to listen to anybody in terms of how it does its economic activity. And the other part of it is also receiving a lot of aid from outside, and those aids are not conditional on any kind of economic reform. But the formula about how countries open up to global economy and open up to trade is already fairly well established and is a path that has been well traveled by countries in Asia and Latin America.
Vali Nasr is my guest. His new book is called Forces of Fortune. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Chris in Dallas. Hello, Chris.
Hi. You were talking earlier about some of the more middle-class and economically progressive parts of the Muslim world, and specifically about Dubai, which kind of caught my attention. I might need a geography lesson, but I don't really understand how the governmental organization of the United Arab Emirates works. But I kind of have two questions. One is, Dubai is one of the Emirates. I'm wondering how their economic progress and success is viewed by, let's say, Abu Dhabi, another Emirate, and what kind of, you know, religious tensions there could be between those two Emirates. And then the other thing is, too, and I could be wrong about this, but my impression of Dubai is that it is not middle class at all. It's really only being built and engineered to serve the extreme upper class. I realize you need middle class workers and engineers and architects and what have you to make this happen, but ultimately, isn't that city just basically going to be driving the polar opposite of economic classes? An extremely rich upper class, and which will and the middle class who built it will eventually devolve into poverty. So if you could speak to maybe those two things.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Well, Dubai is not typical of anywhere else. It's a very small city-state, so it's not in of itself a model. And it is true that the native population, the Arab population, is doing exceptionally well and is very wealthy. But Dubai is its importance to this argument is that it's a proof of concept. In other words, once Dubai opened itself to world trade and allowed production, consumption, it built businesses, it built malls, vacation centers, etc., we witnessed something very interesting, and that is that Muslims from all over the Muslim world came to Dubai to, first of all, act as private sector businessmen, capitalist businessmen, in a manner that they couldn't do so in their own countries. And secondly, they came there and engaged in middle-class behavior, consumption, activities, entertainment, vacation, etc., that is typical of middle classes everywhere. So what Dubai showed is that if Muslims are allowed to become middle classes, if the limits of them becoming middle classes is lifted off of them, they behave like middle classes everywhere else. They consume in a similar manner. They produce in a similar manner. They invest in family, quality of family life, quality of time, etc., that we associate with middle classes everywhere else. So it challenged the argument that the problem in the Muslim world is Islam. Dubai showed that, you know, Muslims can be raging capitalists like everywhere else. Now, Dubai, this is still the case, Dubai is the most popular destination from Muslims all over the world, from Indonesia to Morocco. Why do they like Dubai? It's not because it has mosques. They go to Dubai to have fun. They go to Dubai to do shopping, and they go to Dubai to do business. And Dubai is a mix of Disney World and Las Vegas. So, you know, the taste of the Muslim world, particularly the middle class of the Muslim world, is not that different from the taste of the middle class everywhere else. So above everything else, Dubai is a proof of concept. Now, Dubai became Dubai because Dubai actually doesn't have much oil, unlike Abu Dhabi or Qatar or Saudi Arabia. Dubai had to find a way to make money. And it decided that the only way to make money is to encourage business to happen on its soil. So it changed its laws. It removed taxes. It created a judicial system that is business-friendly. It created all the infrastructure that businesses need, from internet to roads to telephone to everything else. For instance, one of the things Dubai made possible first time in the Arab world is that you can get a telephone in 24 hours and passports in one day. And what happened is that when businessmen, not just Western businessmen, but Muslim businessmen, they all came to Dubai, and it's the investments that they brought in and the business that they do that has made Dubai a wealthy place. So unlike Abu Dhabi or other oil countries whose wealth comes from, getting oil out of the ground and selling it on international markets, Dubai has earned its money from actually generating business. And the result is that you see very capitalist behavior among Muslims, Arabs, Iranians, Pakistanis who work in Dubai, and you also see middle-class taste for consumption, vacationing, culture, et cetera, that you also associate with middle classes everywhere else. So the question is not Dubai itself, it's what Dubai shows about what is possible. I mean, if this is the case, then imagine if Egypt or Algeria or Pakistan were to undergo the similar kind of economic reform, then, you would have a change which is very similar to how China or India or Brazil began to go from one kind of country to a completely different kind.
Mali Nasser is my guest. His new book is called Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also communicate with us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the line to Nordine in Irving. Hey, Nordine.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a question. I want a question about the middle class in countries such as Egypt or Algeria. It's really shrinking while the richer are getting rich and the poorer are getting poor. Is it this because of lack of democracy? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, lack of democracy has to do with it, but more important is because that these are closed markets, because these are not really economies that are open to the world. Algeria still lives off of its oil by and large. Its economy is fairly closed. I mean, if you were to compare Algeria with Morocco, Morocco has integrated into Europe much more. And Egypt also is still fairly closed economy. These are economies that are not doing a lot of business in the world. You don't go to stores in America and find T-shirts or toys that says made in Egypt or made in Algeria on it. And because you don't have that, as a result, you don't have a middle class. And what happens is that you have wealth at the very top in government circles and the elite, and then you have the bottom of the society, which is very large. So the middle class is very small. One reason you don't have democracy in these countries is because the middle class is very small. And one reason you don't have wealth is also because the middle class is very small. And the middle class is very small because you really don't have business with the world.
Should we account in the West for the middle class and its development in aid allocations? In other words, are we better off channeling a greater percentage of aid resources to economic development in those places as opposed to strictly humanitarian aid?
Well, if by economic development we don't mean just poverty alleviation and giving money for basic support for poverty or infrastructure, yes, our aid should demand that in exchange for the money that we give, that the countries that receive aid do to their economies what Dubai and Turkey did to their economies. In other words, they accept economic changes. Now, these are sometimes painful changes, and that's why governments don't like to do it, because it's politically costly to, for instance, divert money from industries that are protected by tariffs and by government regulation and shift the money to a completely new sector that can produce things that you and I would want to buy in the United States. But unless these governments are forced to make those hard decisions, they're not likely to make them. So it is good to sort of think ways in which aid can actually push countries to take steps that they may not want to take unless they're forced to.
Are the countries in the Middle East that have more diversified economies? You mentioned the fact that Dubai doesn't really have a lot of oil. Are they actually in a better position to make this transition than the states that rely wholly on oil?
Yes, absolutely. Generally, countries that are wealthy can always procrastinate in doing undertaking necessary things. And there is a very simple reason for that, because what is economically logical is not politically logical. If we were to say, you know, why don't you close this factory and open another factory? That looks pretty simple to an economist, but it means laying off, you know, thousands of people and diverting money from a segment of the country and then giving it to somebody else, and there's always going to be resistance. And politicians tend to respond much more to political pressure than economic pressure. If there is money from somewhere, either you're getting money aid from the West, or you're getting money from oil or from copper or international aid, etc., it's always easy for you to procrastinate. But ultimately, if you're poorer, you'll have to make those hard decisions.
Ali Nasser is with us this hour. He is professor of international relations at Tufts University. His newest book is called Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. We'll get to more of your calls in just a couple of minutes. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Vali Nasser. He is professor of international relations at Tufts University. His new book is called Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Laura in Wichita Falls. Hi, Laura.
Hello. I'm glad for this opportunity to talk.
Welcome.
I've seen how our middle class is shrinking here in the United States because deregulation has gone too far, and they've stopped. The government has stopped making businesses pay a living wage to their workers. So I want to ask the gentleman what they will do to keep their middle class intact.
Well, you know, the problem in most of the Muslim world is that they don't have a middle class to actually try to defend. They have a very different set of problems than the United States has. The U.S. is a economically developed, fully industrial society, which has had a very large middle class that is responsible for the progress and development of this country, as well as for its stability and for its democracy. And the challenge is actually to protect and preserve the middle class in the United States. In much of the Muslim world, the middle class doesn't exist yet. So their challenge is actually to try to create the middle class, whereas in the United States it is to preserve the middle class. And that would require a completely different set of laws and policies and economic measures in order to achieve each of these things.
Vali, have you seen the middle-class economies within the Muslim world trying deliberately to influence their neighbors in terms of cultivating a middle class?
Well, the most important way that they can influence their neighbors is through commerce. For instance, you see the Turkish business community is interested in investing in the Arab world, is interested in investing in Asia. It is now doing aggressive business with Malaysia, Indonesia, with Iran, with Pakistan, with Jordan, Syria. Turkish businesses invested very heavily in northern Iraq, for instance. And part of the reason for the boom of northern Iraq compared to southern Iraq has to do with Turkish business. So, you know, they're not picking up a microphone and try to broadcast and preach ideology and say, look, we're moderate, you should be moderate. That never works. What they do is what businessmen do, period, which is businessmen look for business opportunity. They look for markets, they look for cheap labor, and they look for places to invest, and they look to importing and exporting things. And as these private sectors in places like Dubai or like Turkey are becoming wealthier, they're also going regional. And as they go regional, they have to find partners in those countries to do business with. So as a result, then if those businesses take off, they help to grow the business class where they go. But what is necessary for this to happen is that the countries next to Turkey or to Dubai or these other places have to reform their laws in order to encourage the business to come in. I mean, one reason why northern Iraq took off is because after the war, you no longer had a very sort of a closed Iraqi economy run by bureaucrats out of Baghdad. The situation allowed, you know, a Turkish businessman to go and look for building a hotel, buying fruit and agricultural goods in northern Iraq, selling things there. And then if he found local Kurdish partners, and those local Kurdish partners as a result have become richer, and you now have a Kurdish middle class in northern Iraq, which is one of the reasons why northern Iraq is much more stable and prosperous.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak next with Jonathan in Dallas. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, Chris. First time caller, long time listener.
Welcome.
Thanks a lot. I want to start off by saying that Mr. Nassif has made some really interesting points throughout this show. One point I wanted to touch back on was he mentioned that the non-existence of a middle-class society in the Middle East, having been born and brought up in Qatar and stayed there for about 20 years, I can very much attest for the fact that there is and there does exist a middle-class society. It might not be recognized by the government or by the locals, but that is definitely the slice of society which runs the country. My question to Mr. Narsa is, with capitalism comes a lot of negative points that we don't really often see it's very evident here in the United States, but for example, right about this time last year, Dubai and places like Qatar experienced a very negative impact on their economies. A lot of companies were laying off people more as a preemptive strike. And, for example, what you did find was a lot of expatriates were just jumping ship, and you actually found brand new cars that were being left at airports with the keys still in the ignition. And what they were pretty much doing was, like, rather than paying off the car, they were just packing their family up and heading back to wherever they came from. Now, and I just wanted to see what your guest had to say in response to that.
Well, both very good points, and I'm glad you raised them. Regarding the first is that not every kind of middle class plays the historical role that I'm mentioning. The Muslim world does have a middle class that goes back to the 1920s and 30s and even before to the 19th century. But it's not a capitalist, private sector-based middle class. It's been largely dependent on government for its culture, for its economy. It consists of either businessmen whose wealth come from government contracts, from oil money, or often they are salaried government workers. They are not what in the West we call a bourgeoisie. In other words, a wealth-generating middle class that operates on the basis of free market and global trade. that is a, and in Turkey, it's actually the best case because Turkey had a middle class of the old school, which was very secular, which was very dependent on the government economically and politically. But that's not the middle class that has made Turkey part of the, you know, the one of the 20 largest economies in the world and a Muslim democracy. It's that other middle class that has come out more recently as a consequence of Turkey's opening to the world. This one, unlike the other one, is actually religious, and but it's also much more capitalist and open to global economy. The first middle class depended on the government. This one depends on the market, and that's the big difference. Now, the point you make is absolutely correct. You know, there is a paradox about capitalism that we know from Western history. It's probably one of the most important transformative forces in world history. It accounts for the rise of the West. It accounts for the wealth of the West. It accounts for industrial revolution, for the technological revolution we live in. And the wealthiest and most powerful countries in the world became powerful and wealthy because of the force of capitalism. But capitalism also, if it's not regulated, if it's not watched, can have a downside. In other words, it can cause crashes, and it can be socially extremely brutal. We saw that last year in New York. We don't need to look at too far away at Dubai, that banks who acted recklessly and were not watched over almost caused the complete collapse of the U.S. economy. Millions of people in the United States lost their jobs, and it is the consequence of what happened in New York that caused the collapse in Dubai, as well as many other places around the world. Now, the lesson of that is not that capitalism is bad, because you know, even in the United States, despite the AIGs and subprime mortgage, we still believe in the free market, except we believe that it has to be better regulated. And now in Dubai, there may have been mistakes in the management of the economy and in the way in which they handled the downturn. They have to learn from that and do it better. But that does not negate the fact that the transformation that Dubai achieved during the past two decades had to do with its opening to the global economy. Because unlike Qatar or unlike Abu Dhabi, it didn't have oil money to subsidize its growth. So the lesson for the Muslim world is that they need to rely on the force of capitalist transformation to get them into the rest, help them catch up with the rest of the world, with Latin America, Asia, India, and ultimately the West. But that they are not immune from the downside of capitalism either. There's going to be market crashes. There's going to be things like happened in Wall Street, and there's going to be income inequality and poverty and grievances that go with capitalism as well. And just like America and Europe have learned to deal with these things, the Muslim countries who become capitalists have to learn to deal with it as well.
Fali, is it reasonable to expect that Western interests could expect to profit from the phenomenon of a growing Muslim middle class beyond simply reducing what we see as instability and threats in the region?
Absolutely. I mean, ultimately, we know we think of China or of India as sort of the next great barrier for markets, et cetera. Not everybody in China is actually middle class. Maybe 20-30% of the country at most is a middle class, and it's become a huge global market. Now, the size of China's population of 1.23 billion people is the same as the population of the Muslim world, 1.3 billion people. And if there is a middle class, which is the consuming, producing, economically vibrant heart of the middle class, Muslim world, grow larger, more prosperous, then it will be a massive market and a business opportunity for the rest of the world. I mean, the whole importance of Dubai that is showed that when Muslims become middle class, they consume and spend and want things like every other middle class. So the Muslim middle class is not different than the Chinese middle class. And the bigger it gets, not only will it be a force for stability at home and democracy, but also it would be a major boost to the global economy as well.
We'll go back to the phones now, and this time speak with Murray in Wichita Falls. Hello, Murray.
Good afternoon. I'm kind of curious. It's expecting the author to know a great deal about the entire Muslim world, which I think is a bit demanding. But I'm kind of curious, being a regular visitor to Morocco, how he sees the growth of capitalism in the Moroccan situation, particularly where you have a authoritarian monarchy. The monarchy there does not have, it's really an absolute monarchy, and the monarch himself is a heavy investor in capitalistic projects. The very large grocery chain called Marjan is reputedly owned by the king. Again, I guess my question is more, you know, how does he see the growth of capitalism in general in Morocco?
Well, Morocco is somewhat of an in-between case. In other words, it's much more open and doing a lot better than the rest of the Arab world, but it is not Turkey or Dubai or Malaysia either. Morocco, more than any other Arab country, has opened its economy in the direction of Europe. And I would say Morocco is probably where Mexico was with the United States in the early 1990s, late 1980s. Namely, it was beginning to integrate into the American market. It was producing cheap goods, using cheap labor for exports. Excess labor was migrating to the U.S. It's the same situation with Morocco and Europe. But that has not yet taken Morocco over the top. And Morocco has to open up its economy more. It has to integrate in Europe more. It's going in the right direction. Then it will pass the tipping point. And I think the change in the political structures in Morocco are going to come further down the road when the economy actually passes a certain threshold in terms of becoming a self-sustaining, wealth-generating economy. So I think, you know, the political transformation will come, but the growth of private sector, capitalist, Europe-oriented economy in Morocco has not yet reached the level to force the political change. So, and if we took cases from Asia like Korea or Taiwan in the 1980s, you had dictatorship that was growing the economy. And then there is a point at which wealth eventually forces dictatorship itself to change. So dictatorship causes wealth, and then wealth will cause change in dictatorship. And we hope that that will happen in Morocco as well.
In the 15 seconds or so that we have left, you write that we can't win a culture war with the Middle East even if we try. What happens if we stop trying?
I think we should do business with the Middle East and let business do the culture war rather than we doing the culture war. Wherever we've had success, that seems to have been the formula.
Vali Nasser is professor of international relations at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. His latest book is called Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. Vali, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.